So many acres of newsprint were devoted to them at the time, and so many books have been written about them since, and 50 years ago a landmark film was made about their exploits, that it takes a brave woman to write anything more about the brothers Joe and Jimmy Governor, Wiradjuri men who brutally murdered 9 people in central New South Wales in 1900. That brave woman is my guest today, Catherine Biber, author of The Last Outlaws, The Crimes of Jimmy and Joe Governor and the Birth of Modern Australia. Catherine is Distinguished Professor of Law at UTS. Her field is evidence. Her interest in the Governor brothers goes back about 20 years. Her podcast on their crimes and trials, also called The Last Outlaws, won a slew of prizes a couple of years ago, including the New South Wales Premier's History Award and also Podcast of the Year. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, David.
Why does this story grab you? Why?
Oh, there are so many reasons, David, and the reasons have changed over time. Originally, it grabbed me through the film, and I was shocked after seeing the film to learn that it was based on true events that I had not heard about or studied. So it started by me feeling that this story should be more well known. I was surprised that it wasn't more well known, and I went looking for it in more kind of conventional books about Australian history, and either it was entirely omitted or it was mentioned in passing with a kind of shame or a sense that it didn't quite fit the narrative. But I've returned to it over and over again, trying to work out how this story can be inserted into a broader understanding of Australian history, because I started with a hypothesis that the response to the Governor brothers actually shaped modern Australia. And when I went looking for evidence of that, I found a lot of evidence. And so this is my attempt to demonstrate how Jimmy and Joe Governor brothers' crimes and the public response to them were actually instrumental in shaping the institutions that we rely on today and which made modern Australia.
Okay. Now, that's a big aim.
Yes.
Let's go back to the crimes themselves. What did those young men do?
Well, as you've said, they murdered 9 people. 7 of their victims were either women or children. One of those women was heavily pregnant, already in her confinement. They also very seriously injured other people who did not die of those injuries. 2 of their murder victims were white men. They also committed other crimes, primarily robberies. Jimmy Governor was also accused of raping a teenage girl, although that was never investigated and he was never charged with that offence. But for a period of 3 months, commencing with 9 murders, they committed a range of other crimes on the New South Wales late frontier and were very, very difficult to capture.
And they were the focus of extraordinary interest from the public and the press. This was an archetypal Australian press story, was it not?
That's right. Look, today criminologists would call the press response a moral panic, because every theory, every clue, every fragment was reported on and discussed in the media, often with no evidentiary basis.
So you make that clear in the book. There is, in a lot of places, for the most colourful details, no evidence, whatever.
That's right. But they made great copy. And I suppose the media is one of the institutions that my book argues was shaped by this case, because it created scandal, it created sensationalism, and all of the kind of contemporary tropes that we rely on in reporting on crime and the public response to crime are all evident in the public report, in the media reports on this case.
Can I suggest a theory? And I'm going to use the language of the time, and that's this, that a great deal of the fascination about Jimmy Governor lay in the contrast between his brutal crimes and the notion that he was really the best kind of young black. He spoke good English, he'd had a bit of education, he played cricket. Catherine, he played cricket. and yet he did these crimes. What do you think of that theory?
Yes, that's a powerful theory, and I think it's also important to remember that we're talking about the language of the times. But he did what most of the white governors wanted Aboriginal people to do. He spoke English, he read and wrote English, he had a job, he worked for white people.
Good worker.
He was a good worker. He was skilled in all of the kind of rural trades that needed skilled workers. He was willing to travel for work. He was willing to employ others to help him to do the work. So in many ways, he was exactly the kind of entrepreneurial, hardworking frontier man. But he crossed the line, many people believe, by taking a white woman as his wife.
Now, when you look at the explanations for the crimes, how strongly do you give the role of Jimmy Governor's wife, Ethel, in those killings?
Well, I suppose, and you're right, my field is evidence, and I've examined the evidence, and there's a huge volume of evidence. It's very difficult with the distance of time to know how important any individual item of evidence was at the time. But it's true that there was evidence that his wife, who was white, experienced humiliation from white people for taking a black man as her husband and also having children with him. And those children were humiliated for being of what we would not today call mixed race. So certainly she was very unhappy, and certainly she was telling him about his unhappiness, and he absorbed a lot of her anger and unhappiness, and it was a factor.
She was, at the time, like her husband, working for the Morbury family, and there is evidence, is there not, that she was humiliated by the Morbury women. Mrs. Morbury, a governess in the household, had been particularly humiliating to Ethel. One of the things that fascinates me about the killings is that there had been a row between Ethel and Jimmy in the hours before the killings. He went off with his brother Joe, committed the killings. They didn't kill Morbury. They killed Mrs. Morbury. They killed the women in the household. Does that count, and I'm speaking to a professor of the law of evidence here, does that count in sort of a vague notion that Ethel set him on to do those crimes?
Yes, that's a hard question to answer. I suppose today we use the language of provocation. And there was a version of provocation at the time. And certainly many defendants, including people who were defendants in homicide cases, used some kind of provocation defence successfully. None of those were Aboriginal people, but certainly a kind of provocation that was an accumulation of humiliation and accrued unhappiness was used in evidence to excuse people of their crimes.
Now, we'll get to the trial, but before we get to the trial, having committed these murders, Joe, Jimmy and their mate Jack Underwood fled into the bush. And though there was an immense manhunt, they evaded capture for how long?
It was about 3 months.
About 3 months. And that gave them a kind of magical status as well, didn't it, in the eyes of the press and the public. Fearful but magical. They had got away.
Yes, that's right. And that's why the press started to report every theory and clue, because it was thought that they had these kind of skills and abilities to elude capture, to hide their footprints in the bush, to subsist on who knows what. They certainly had very advanced skills in survival in the bush, as did many people who lived in the region, but there was a very kind of satisfying media commentary about a kind of dialogue they were having with their hunters. It was thought that they were leaving clues for their hunters. They would leave, apparently, notes for their hunters. Sometimes they would steal flour and they would use that flour to leave footprints on the ground. So it was thought that there was this kind of seductive dance between them and their pursuers, which was designed really to humiliate the police, because the longer they couldn't be captured, the more humiliation accrued to the police who couldn't find them.
And that was always amusing for the public, for the police to be a bit humiliated, even in the midst of a panic. But was there also a sense that we were back to the bushranger days?
Well, that's right. And that's an interesting term, because many historians have thought that bushrangers were finished by 1900.
Yes,
and all over. So the term was kind of thrown about occasionally, but it felt like it was not the right term anymore for what they had done. So there wasn't really agreement about what label to use for these men. And I also am not sure what label to use. I mean, today they might be mass murderers or serial killers. Some people have thought they're freedom fighters, but I don't think there is any kind of convenient label in Australian history to put on the Governor Brothers.
But you bring to this argument a fascination with an almost exhausted form of law, outlawry. Now, the Kelly brothers had been outlawed, and now, after a political uproar, the Governor brothers were outlawed. Now, what did it mean to be outlawed?
Yes, so actually outlawry in Australian history has a long history, but you're right. There was an instrument called the Felons Apprehension Act. It was first introduced in 1865 by Sir Alfred Stephen, and the idea of outlawing someone under the Felons Apprehension Act, and each act was supposed to apply to a named individual, was to proclaim them an outlaw. They would have to go through a process that was approved by a Supreme Court judge, who would affirm that this person was guilty of a crime and could not be captured. So it's a finding of guilt without a trial. And these people would have 14 days to surrender themselves. And if they did not, then after that 14 days had elapsed, they could be captured dead or alive. And if they were captured dead, then those who killed them would not be guilty of a homicide.
How many times were people actually formally in this way declared outlaws in the colony? Because I think you argue, and I would argue, that it was not really necessary to go through these formalities. But how many times were there sort of formal declarations? This person is an outlaw.
So these formal declarations were made 10 times, and Jimmy and Joe Governor were number 9 and 10.
Well, but isn't that how the law operated on the frontier anyway? People were shot, killed, particularly Indigenous people were shot and killed, and nobody bothered much. The law was somehow didn't apply to them. It was as if they were already, without declaration, outlaws.
That's right. And in fact, and this is something that the book does explore a little bit, there is a much longer history to outlaws in the Australian colonies, and there were also formal declarations. Whether the word outlaw was used, it was used haphazardly. Sometimes people were declared ruffians or other, you know.
I like that, ruffians.
Ruffians.
A formal declaration of ruffianism.
That's right. Some were declared daring banditti.
No.
And so this kind of language goes back actually to the very earliest years of the convict era, where originally convicts were declared outlaws. These were convicts who had reoffended whilst in the colonies. But also we start to see outlawry proclamations being made against First Nations people. Sometimes it's made against convicts who've gone to live with Aboriginal people.
And yes, the ones who went over to the other side.
And sometimes they're made against Aboriginal people who have, for some other reason, fallen afoul of the colonial governors.
I am talking to Professor Catherine Biber about her book, The Last Outlaws, a book that examines the crimes and trials of the Governor brothers. Catherine, Joe Governor was shot and killed. What happened to his body?
Well, Joe Governor was shot and killed outside the New South Wales town of Singleton, in a very remote area. And so police took a very, very long time to arrive at the body, and they threw him over the back of a pack horse and conveyed him to the road. And then by road, they conveyed him to Singleton, where they laid him out on the billiard table in the Caledonian Hotel. The Caledonian Hotel is still in Singleton. At this time, though, they held coronial inquests in regional areas, often in pubs. And so they held a coronial inquest in the Caledonian Hotel. Joe's body was laid out on the billiard table, but not in the public bar. But a jury was convened, because juries served on coronial inquests at that time. A jury was convened from amongst 12 men who were just drinking in the pub. And an inquest was held into the cause of his death. Because as we know, shooting dead an outlaw is not a crime, but the court needed to be satisfied, the coroner needed to be satisfied that he was an outlaw and that he was Joe Governor and that the people who shot him knew those things. And so a full legal proceeding happens in the pub, and it concludes that his killers were not guilty of a crime. But also it reveals that there were transactions made between colonial legal figures and colonial medical figures. And what I learned was that his body, after his inquest, was trafficked into the global body trade.
Why was there such an interest, particularly in the brains of Indigenous criminals?
Well, it's important, I suppose, to remember at this time, anatomists, the field of anatomy is developing. And within the field of anatomy is a subfield called neuroanatomy. And anatomists and other scientists at the time are trying to understand the spectrum of humanity and how humans differ from non-human animals. So they're really trying to plot creatures on a spectrum, or we would say a hierarchy, probably a racial hierarchy. And so, yes, they were interested in Aboriginal people and where Aboriginal people fit on this hierarchy. But of course, Aboriginal people and their brains were trafficked just as much as the brains and remains of other kinds of peoples. And when I tried to investigate what happened to the remains of Joe Governor, I discovered a whole world in which First Nations peoples' remains, but also the remains of all of humanity and also all the other creatures that were not human, were being trafficked by very, very eminent scientific gentlemen across the globe.
You write that the examination of Indigenous body parts, particularly brains, was to justify imperialism. What did you mean?
Well, in large part, when we talk about the making of modern Australia, we are talking about the kind of legal instruments that created the nation. But in this part of the book, we remember that scientists played a very important role in the making of modern Australia, and that science and what we would call racial science was very important to our understanding of society, social hygiene, public health. All of these important institutions of modern nation-making were developed by scientists, including scientists who traded in human bodies. And so it's really just a reminder that the making of a nation is not just about a constitutional agreement amongst lawyers, but it's also being developed, in this case, by scientists and anatomists who are trading human and non-human remains because they think that's important to understanding the society that they are going to be governing.
So that's Joe. Now, Jimmy is finally captured and brought to trial. Now, part of the fascination of this book is the examination of the legal procedures. I mean, you know, as I was a lawyer for a couple of days, Catherine, a long time ago, and I loved this examination of the many awful breaches of little rules and big rules in bringing Jimmy to trial. Now, we've only, alas, got a few minutes left. Firstly, I want to ask, Ethel, when she gave evidence, didn't really help her husband, did she?
No, it's true. Ethel gave evidence probably in exchange for her own freedom because she had been charged and was ultimately not brought to trial.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether she and Jimmy had made an arrangement about the evidence she would or wouldn't give, or whether she was overwhelmed. It's important to remember she was 18 years old and pregnant with another child, and probably desperate and incredibly precarious. She was living in the benevolent asylum at the time and had no idea of what lay ahead of her. But it's true, the evidence she gave did not really help Jimmy Governor.
Now, we won't go through all of the irregularities of the trial, but do you think, even if the trial had been perfectly conducted, even if Jimmy Governor had had solicitors and barristers representing him with actual experience of the criminal law, which these ones didn't, do you think he could possibly have been acquitted?
No, I don't. It's true his lawyers were not experienced criminal lawyers, and it's true that there were much better criminal lawyers available in the colony. He did have an appeal, though, and on appeal, yes, he did have one of the best barristers. And as soon as, after Federation, the High Court was established, his barrister was appointed to the first bench of the High Court, Richard O'Connor. So even though he didn't have the best lawyers at his trial for the crime he was accused of, he had a pretty good shot. And also, I think his judge was very fair. And so in the legal context at the time, he had the best available opportunity for an acquittal, but I don't think any jury at this time would ever have acquitted an Aboriginal man accused of murdering 9 white people on the colonial frontier.
Nor today, surely.
Probably not.
Mm. Now look, there's so much here. One of the details, the little details that I found extraordinary was, firstly, that most people condemned to be hanged were not hanged. Most had their sentences commuted. Most Aboriginal men and women committed to be hanged also had their sentences commuted. What decided that Jimmy Governor would actually hang?
Yes, that is true. At this time in 1900, mercy, which was a commutation of someone's death penalty, was more commonly dealt than not. And it's true that the colonial hangman at this time mostly did other things. He worked in the garden in Darlinghurst Jail. He washed the dishes in the Darlinghurst Courthouse.
And he was a dud at his job.
That's true. He botched a lot of his executions, probably because there were not that many people he was hanging. But I don't think that Jimmy Governor could ever have been given mercy because of the politics of this time. And this is really the argument of the book. This case is very closely entangled with the emerging nation that is literally days away from the delivery of his death sentence. And so the shadow of nation-making looms over the decision to execute him, which was made by the Executive Council after it was delivered by his judge.
And once he was waiting to be hanged, he was descended on by people who somehow wanted to make their own careers out of the prospect of his death.
That's right. He waited a long time in the condemned cell at Darlinghurst Jail, longer than normal. The normal procedure was that you would have 3 Sundays and then you would be executed, but he waited much longer. It's not, many have said that he was waiting until after the Federation celebrations had concluded. I never found a document that proved why his sentence was supposed to be delivered on the 18th of January.
Because as he waited there, the processions were being held all around Australia, documents were being signed, the nation was coming into being.
The Federation celebrations paraded down Oxford Street outside the jail. The jail provided the electricity for the lights that powered the Federation decorations on Oxford Street. So yes, whether those two events were literally connected, I never discovered. But it's true that whilst he was waiting, a huge parade of visitors entered the condemned cell. And one of them was a young missionary called Retta Dixon, who visited him 23 times in 1 month.
Brought him to the Lord, did she not?
She said that she did. She believed that she brought about his salvation prior to his execution. And later in her life, she wrote a memoir that she never published, but which is in the State Library of New South Wales, about the days that she spent praying with him in the condemned cell. And she would become a hugely influential missionary in the lives of Aboriginal people. Her mission was very, very important and very impactful in the Christianisation of Aboriginal people.
But alas, we have no time to follow the career of Retta. Catherine, thank you for joining me on Late Night Live to discuss the story of the Governor Brothers.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Catherine Biber, author of The Last Outlaws. This is Late Night Live.